Oh, hello, it's Johnny in for Stephen. Over the next few hours, the row continues about freebies. We'll be live at the Labour Party conference to speak to one of the newer Labour MPs. And also on the programme tonight, home education and fussy eating. We want to hear your stories about the things you just cannot eat or the weird and wonderful things you have to eat. 08085 909 693 for your calls.
Voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the BBC News on 5 Live at 10 o'clock, I'm Richard Foster. The Labour Party conference has opened in Liverpool with promises to improve workers' rights, build high-quality homes and strengthen communities. But the event's being overshadowed by rows over the salary of Sir Keir Starmer's chief of staff and gifts from the Labour donor Lord Alley. The Environment Secretary Steve Reid says they have to be honest with voters.
We also have to show people that through this darkness there comes light. And the reason we were elected was to change things, to make things better. People need to know they voted for change and they will get change. That's why our slogan, and you can see it on the walls all around us, change begins. It's not going to be done overnight. This is the start in the much bigger change that this country needs.
President Biden says he's doing everything he can to stop a war breaking out between Israel and the Lebanese group Hezbollah after both threatened to step up cross-border attacks. Fadi Alameh is a Lebanese MP who chairs its Parliamentary Foreign Affairs Committee. He says the US can play a major role in finding a resolution.
We need peace on the border. We need to get back our territory. It's been occupied by the Israelis for ages now. We believe in diplomacy, and that's what we're trying to do. And we're hoping with the back channel diplomacy that something can, you know, move forward before things further escalate.
The Justice Secretary says she's furious that some prisoners have been released early without ankle tags. Shabana Mahmood has been demanding answers from the prison's contractor Serco and says the company could face penalties. Police in Alabama are still searching for gunmen who shot dead four people in the city of Birmingham. 18 others were injured when shots were fired last night. Truman Fitzgerald is from the Birmingham Police Department.
We believe that multiple shooters fired on a large group of people who were outside in the open. We have no one in custody, and the Birmingham Police Department has reached out to our federal partners with the ATF and the FBI to assist us.
People with asthma or severe acne will no longer be banned from joining Britain's armed forces. The Defence Secretary John Healey says he wants to end what he sees as outdated entry requirements so he can tackle a recruitment crisis. He'll also announce plans so that computer gamers can join a new cyber defence effort. And Liam Gallagher says imposters aren't welcome at the Oasis reunion concerts next year. It's after he was criticised for a performance before the fight between Anthony Joshua and Daniel Dubois last night. Reviews were mixed, but he says people didn't appreciate his angelic tones.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Well, hello. And welcome along. What a joy it is to be here. 3 minutes past 10. You are listening to BBC Radio 5 Live. And it's Johnny Iannson in for Stephen tonight. It should have been a victory parade for Labour at their party conference in Liverpool. But instead of talking policy, Labour MPs are explaining why they're accepting gifts and freebies. All declared, of course, like Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson's 14 grand birthday bashes paid for by a Labour donor.
The first event was ahead of my birthday, so I was turning 40. I thought it was a good opportunity to get people together in a professional context. So it was journalists, trade unionists, education people, MPs and shadow cabinet.
If a Tory had done that, I know exactly what you'd be saying to me this morning. They should pay for their own birthday parties.
Now, on Friday, the Prime Minister announced he won't accept any more freebie clothing after it emerged his work wardrobe was donated. And Labour leader Angela Rayner, deputy leader, is facing questions about a New York holiday and some nice clobber too.
Lord Alley gave you individually more than £20,000. What did you promise or give him in return?
I promised nothing and gave him nothing in return. What the donors and that have helped me in the past have done is seen someone that's come from a very working class background, and as you said before, I say it how it is.
We'll be live at the conference in Liverpool next with a new Labour MP, Jessica Toll. And later this hour, fussy eaters, are you one or do you live with one?
It is sensory. It's texture, smell. It's looking at it thinking, oh, I'm not really sure about that. I'm not sure I want to put that in my mouth.
As the father of a four-year-old, I am well aware of the difficulties of trying to get your offspring to eat. So we'll get into that more on the programme later on. And, well, a new study suggests it might not be their fault. It could be a genetic condition. The Nolan programme is all about your calls. Here's how to get in touch.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Call free 08085 909 693. Text 85058. Texts will be charged at your standard message rate. Plus, see our privacy notice. bbc.co.uk/5live.
BBC Radio 5 Live. The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live. Johnny Iamson.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
So let's go straight to Liverpool. Labour having their first annual party conference since July's landslide general election victory. It comes amid attempts to defuse a growing row over donated gifts, which has dogged the start of the conference. Today, the Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, has insisted the Labour government is open and transparent after facing criticism about the gifts and donations senior figures receive. She said she understood why people were frustrated and angry about the issue, but that donations had been a feature of UK politics for a very long time. Speaking at the conference this afternoon, Business Secretary Jonathan Reynolds told the BBC that no one has done anything wrong and the system is transparent.
When you are a politician, even if you are engaging with something as a friend, you have to declare that because of the transparency, rightly so. When you are in a front bench position, whether that's the shadow or the actual government job, you will be invited to things as part of your job. The shadow culture secretary will always have more invitations than most other people to things. But we have a transparent system. There's no change. There's been no change under Labour in the current rules that we have. That is exactly how it should be. But that is not in any way questionable or wrong. This is our system, and it's very different to say what we had under the last government, where they had major questions about, say, those COVID procurement contracts, where there's a special access process for Conservative donors. This is just the transparency we have as parliamentarians. No one has done anything wrong. There's no suggestion of improper influence. This is the transparent system that we have. I think that's a good thing.
On the conference floor, it was the Deputy PM who gave the first major speech of the conference. Angela Rayner focused on house building, devolution and workers' rights, as she told delegates that the new government had already got to work changing the country.
80 days in government and we've been busy. A devolution revolution, a bill to deliver new rights and protections for renters, planning reform to get Britain building, a landmark review to fix our NHS, a child poverty task force, 100 new specialist officers to tackle criminals, an end to one-word Ofsted inspections, ending the ban on onshore wind and fines for bosses who pollute our waters, bills to kickstart Great British Energy and to prevent another Liz Truss disastrous mini-budget, put buses in local hands and bring rail into public ownership. Conference change has begun.
Well, tomorrow will be the turn of Chancellor Rachel Reeves to take to the floor. Front cover of The Eye today, by the way. Reeves urged not to return to austerity as Labour faces winter fuel revolt. I wonder just how perhaps we'll hear a more positive, optimistic turn from the Chancellor in her speech tomorrow. We'll see. And let's talk to Harry Farley about it, our correspondent who can talk to us about what's happening in Liverpool. Evening to you, Harry.
Evening, Johnny. Hi.
Good. It's the first conference then in 15 years, the first conference of the Labour Party actually being in power since that landslide. It should be a jubilant, optimistic, hopeful mood. I guess there's one of frustration at the moment as well because of the firefighting that's going on.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. I mean, I think we sometimes have to sort of step back a bit from the headlines and I guess reflect on that fact that it is 14, you know, Labour had a long time in opposition, 14 years. And there is, when I walk around the conference floor, that I suppose that sense of triumph, that sense of optimism. I've just come back from a number of parties that have been going on, and there is a sense of celebration behind those headlines, I suppose. And I think that is also shown in just the sheer number of businesses, of organisations, of lobby groups that have paid to have stands here because they know this is a party that is now in government. And there is, I suppose, that sense of triumph there. But as you say, you know, it has been a difficult few weeks for the party, questions over the gifts and the freebies that senior cabinet ministers have been receiving, and also questions around the Chancellor's decision to scrap the winter fuel allowance for most pensioners. And it is in that context that I suppose there is a discontent among the party's rank and file, as well as that sense of triumph, I suppose.
Do you think we'll hear any of them actually talk about it or reference it? Because I don't think we have so far, have we? Apart from, you know, obviously the interviews where they've been questioned.
On the winter fuel?
Well, the fuel, or obviously the issues around the freebies at the moment. And I mean in their speeches or openly on the kind of the floor of the party.
Well, I think one of the interesting things that we may well see in the next coming days is whether there is a move from a few unions to try and push a vote on the conference on scrapping, on reversing the government's decision to cut the winter fuel allowance. So I think that will be a really interesting decision as to whether that vote is allowed to go ahead. Some questions over whether that might happen tomorrow. It may be pushed later in the week. But certainly from people, senior figures in different unions that are affiliated to the Labour Party that I've been speaking to, they are very, very unhappy about that decision to scrap the winter fuel allowance for most pensioners. You know, one that I was speaking to today said there were all sorts of other ways that the government could make tough decisions that it has talked about. They said those tough decisions could lie, for example, they want to see things like a wealth tax on the very richest and other solutions to raise the funds to fill that £22 billion black hole the government has talked so much about. So it will be interesting to see whether that vote is allowed to go ahead. If it does, it will be purely symbolic. You know, it won't actually force the government to change their mind. But I think it is illustrative, I suppose, of the frustration there is among a significant number of people here at Labour Party conference, despite all I said, you know, about the fact that this is the first time the Labour Party has gathered for their conference in 15 years as the party of government.
We've heard from David Lammy. We'll talk about him in a moment's time, but let's focus on Angela Rayner for a moment. Big speech today, talking about devolution, workers' rights, house building, which she's obviously incredibly passionate about. How was her speech received today?
Well, I mean, all the speeches on the conference floor are received very well, I'd say, generally. House building, I suppose, I mean, it's difficult to overstate just how significant and how important house building is to this government's success or otherwise. They've set that target of 1.5 million new homes. And I suppose really it's the central plank to their plan to grow the economy. And they've put the growth of the economy right at the heart of their agenda. And I think that really rests on Angela Rayner's brief in delivering that. So I suppose that will be a thing an area of policy that we should keep a close eye on. Will they get close to achieving that 1.5 million target? How many of those homes will be affordable? How many of them will be social? And can they force those developers that often buy up land and then don't actually build out the houses for several years to come? Can they force those developers into action? So I think all these questions yet to be decided. But the speech itself was well received. Angela Rayner, a very popular figure in the Labour Party, in particularly among those union members and that rank and file. But that agenda of house building, really crucial to Labour's success or otherwise in the years to come.
OK, Harry, listen, we're going to let you go because you've got a long few days ahead of you. So keep your powder dry and I'm sure we'll catch up with you on Five Live over the next few days. That's our correspondent Harry Farley there, live from Liverpool. Let's bring in one of the Labour new MPs following the party's landslide victory in July's general election. Jessica Toll was elected as Labour MP for Bournemouth West. And I'm pleased to say that joins us now. Jessica, how are you? How's your first conference been so far?
Hello, Johnny, and thanks for having me on. Well, the atmosphere is fantastic. As your correspondent said, this is our first conference in 15 years as a new party of government, and the energy is certainly there to match that.
It's your first as a Labour MP. Give us a flavour of what it's like to be there. Exciting? Nerves? Are you partying all night? What's been happening for you?
Well, it's very exciting. It is the first chance that I've had to raise the issues that my constituents have brought to me in a conference venue, to be an MP who can really try and move the dial on some of these issues as well. And we actually took time to canvass some of our local residents about the issues they wanted us to raise here at conference. So we had things like the renters reform bill and the impact that would have on renters, which is a big issue for young people in Bournemouth West. We also had requests to go see WASPI women, talk to them about their concerns, issues like hunting bans, various foreign policy issues, which is my background. So there's lots to do, and my schedule is certainly very, very packed over the next few days.
And of course, as we heard there, it should be quite an exciting and jubilant few days for you. But if you pick up any of the papers today, there's a lot of negative press. And today, both on TV and radio, a lot of questions that Labour are being forced to answer that they're finding quite uncomfortable now. One surrounding the winter fuel allowance, which we'll talk about in a moment's time. And the other is over the gifts and freebies that senior members of the parties have received, such as Angela Rayner, been given over £2,000 worth of luxury clothing. Would you have accepted £2,000 worth of clothing from a posh brand if you were an MP?
Well, I think our front bench have all been very open about these. They've declared all of these issues. And I think what we'd like to focus on at this conference is the real massive change that we're trying to bring to Britain now, and that is the focus of this conference. As you've said, Angela Rayner this morning set out amazing plans to really improve the quality and availability of housing across the country, particularly that social and affordable housing, and really start to reverse the decline that we've seen over the last 14 years. And that's what we'd like the focus
on. But the problem is you might want that to be the focus, but because of decisions made by the leadership in your team, such as Sir Keir Starmer taking £16,000 worth of donations of clothing and over £2,000 worth of donations of spectacles alone, we're talking about this. So would you say it was wrong for them to do that because of their decisions? They're taking the limelight away from the policies that we should be talking about.
Like I said, the front bench have answered lots of questions about this from many of your journalists already, and they've been very open done, how they've declared it, and it's all within the line of the
rules.
Of course. And we can have a wider conversation about the rules and whether those should change. But like I said, they're also being very, very focused on the change that this country needs. And that should absolutely be our focus, because we have had 14 years of a government that has seen our economy decline, our public services decline. And there are really tough choices ahead, but there's lots of hope in the future as well. And that's what I get from the people that I'm speaking to at this conference.
And we will talk about that, I promise you. But, you know, blazoned around the conference is Change Begins. One of the cornerstones of your election was that we are doing things different, that we are a party that is different to the Tories who have been before us. Yet we have Angela Rayner saying, well, look, all MPs do it in terms of taking these freebies. Well, that doesn't seem that change does begin with you.
And it does. And we've been in government for 2.5 months. I think this is something that I found really eye-opening as a new MP. People are really anxious for change. They're really frustrated with the cost of living, with not being able to get a GP, and the expectations for change are very high. Now, we tried to manage that during the campaign, and we've talked a lot about trying to restore trust in politics. But all of that takes time to turn around, and we've been very honest about that as well. I think part of being open and honest is receiving the flak that comes with that as well.
Mm-hmm. So if you want to talk about on a broader brush subject matter, then do you think that you should stop accepting freebies? It looks like the likes of Keir Starmer and Angela Rayner said we won't accept clothing anymore, for instance. But should you just stop accepting freebies? Keir Starmer, stop going to the footy. You stop going to concerts that you get offered. Should it all just stop to make it a lot easier for you to deal with this?
Well, there are lots of rules around this, and you'll forgive me. This is not something that I'm dealing with on a daily basis.
No, but your argument was we could, if you want to have a broader discussion about accepting freebies, we can do that. And let's have that now then. Should you just stop accepting freebies?
But what I mean by a broader conversation is that there are quite complex rules around being an MP and gifts and hospitality and things like that. And often they are in the context of doing a job and making sure that we're getting the best deal for the country. And so we're not going to solve this with respect on a conversation at 10 p.m. But I think it is probably worth a conversation, okay, wider conversation about what the public expect from our politicians, how we do our job in the best way. There's lots of things that, you know, even in 2 months I've discovered as being an MP that people don't really understand about the political process, how we work. But it's up on us as well to make the political process more transparent. And I'm very up for having that conversation about what you know, the general public think our role is and how we best fulfil that.
Okay. How do you feel about the criticism that the party is receiving regarding the winter fuel allowance, for instance? I was reading an interview with you prior to becoming elected where you spoke about the importance in your constituency and across the country of looking after older people and also dealing with people's energy bills, yet you voted to cut the winter fuel allowance. So how do you square that one away?
Yeah, we haven't shied away from this as being a really, really tough decision. This wasn't the only measure that we introduced when Rachel Reeves made.
No, but I'm talking about you on a personal level as an MP. Bournemouth West has a large proportion of older voters, for instance.
Yep.
How do you square that away with them choosing to take away their winter fuel allowance, not just as a party, but you as an MP?
No, well, I think this is really important because oftentimes this is talked about as scrapping the winter fuel allowance. That's not correct. What this is a means test on the winter fuel payment. And I've had plenty of emails from constituents who say, I use this for drinks on my cruise or I live in Spain. I don't need it. Mm. Equally, I've had a lot.
I think we might have just lost her. The line has been a little bit flaky over the past couple of minutes. Are you back, Jessica? We just lost you mid-flow there. You were talking to us about, I think you were going to talk to us about the amount of people that had got in touch with you who were upset about it.
Yeah, and I understand that none of us wanted to make this decision, but we were clear that we would have to make tough decisions. What we've been trying to do in the constituency is identify those people who should be in receipt of pension credit and aren't at the moment, or should be in receipt of things like attendance allowance or carers allowance. We've been running specific surgeries on that with volunteers from the Citizens Advice, and that's been fairly successful at getting people entitlements that they didn't previously think that they should be receiving. I do feel for people who are £2-3 over, and we are trying to do everything locally to be able to make sure that those people get through the winter. But the broader picture is pensions have gone up significantly. The energy cap will be lower this year than it was. The household support fund is being extended. Mm. So there are a number of other things that we're doing to try to mitigate. Inflation's gone up hugely
as well, hasn't it?
So and ensure that people who are the most vulnerable are still getting the winter fuel allowance.
I wanted to talk to you about Angela Rayner, the Deputy PM, spoke very passionately because it's an issue close to her heart about strengthening workers' rights and also about building those 1.5 million homes that you've promised. Crucially, she didn't put a figure on the amount of council homes that will be built. Do you think that's a mistake? Because if that is such a passionate policy of yours, then you should have figures to aim for.
I think, you know, this is one of our flagship policies, and we are trying to be the builders in society. And introducing compulsory housing targets back into local government is a really radical policy. We've been very clear that we want to unleash the largest social and affordable house build in a generation. And I think there's still some work to be done to work out where those go and deliver them in areas of most of need. And we're going to work very closely with local governments to do that. And I think that's the right work that needs to happen now.
OK, and a final word about Rachel Reeves. The Chancellor will hear from tomorrow. There's been a lot of worrisome language coming from the likes of Rachel Reeves. Are you concerned, though, it has been overly pessimistic? I mean, do you worry about the fact that it's been very, very bleak, perhaps talking down the UK, maybe affecting confidence in investment even in this country?
I think it's important, and we've always been very clear throughout the election and since we've been elected, that we will need to make tough decisions and there will need to be hard chances to make. But if you look at what we've done in this first 2 months, we've started the process to set up GB Energy and the National Wealth Fund. We've been very clear about our house building targets. We've introduced things like the Rail Franchise Bill and the Better Business Bill. We've had really great engagement with business over the course of this conference. So, you know, we are putting this message of tough choices ahead alongside a very clear vision that over the next 5 to 10 years in Britain, we want to be the builders. We are going to fix the foundations, rebuild our economy and public services. And so, no, I don't think it's bleak. I think we're being realistic about the time that it will take to to really turn the country around because of the inheritance we've had.
Okay, we will wait to see and hear that speech. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of the conference, Jessica, and I appreciate you taking a bit of time out to talk to us tonight.
Cheers. Have a good evening.
Take care. That's Jessica Toll there, elected as Labour MP for Bournemouth West in the election in July. Let's speak to a couple of people that are at the conference as well as Labour supporters and members. Liam Kelly joins us, head of social enterprise Make CIC, which works across the Liverpool City region. Good evening to you, Liam.
Good evening.
And hello to Krish Darayanani, a politics student and ambassador at the European Youth Parliament. Krish, how are you?
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you. Liam, what have you made of what's happened so far? And just in the context of, obviously, your social enterprise, why are you there? What do you hope to gain from it?
Well, I think there's a bit of a battle going on in people's minds about the doom and gloom that you were just talking about, and also the positivity that people want. And I can really sympathise with the situation that has been inherited by politicians, by ministers, with the situation that the country is facing, and they're trying to manage our expectations. And I think that everyone who's being pragmatic can really understand that. But I think we are a bit hopeful that the big hitting speeches that are still to come at conference will actually be a little bit more upbeat, a little bit more positive, and also put a bit of meat to the bone when it comes to what they're actually going to do. So I'm excited to hear all that.
So you provide equipment to emerging artists. That's what Make CIC does, as I understand it. What are you hoping to hear then that will make your life easier or better as a community interest company?
Well, we've been a pretty fortunate beneficiary of the former Levelling Up agenda. Package that however you want, brand that however you want. Investment into towns has been really welcome. And we've been a direct beneficiary of that. We've managed to open a new space that we own and that is forever in the hands of artists in Birkenhead and Wirral. And that's been great. But I think that what we would want to see is for that to be spread across the whole north, maybe even the whole of the country, particularly focused on our cities. I think that the cities that have sort of been left behind a little bit as the Tories focused purely on towns, it seemed. And I'm hopeful that we have a little bit more of an equitable spread of investment and opportunities across the country from this government.
Krish, you're there because you're studying politics, but also because you've got a very personal connection to how politics can improve people's lives. Tell us a little bit about you and your sister and how she's inspired you.
Yes, well, look, my sister is neurodiverse, and essentially it's a little bit hard for us at home. But for me, what's really important is how this Labour government will deliver disability policy in a better way than we saw in the last Tory government. I mean, one of the things that I always point to was Rishi Sunak's cutting down of disability benefit. I personally think that was a disgrace, you know, to our disabled people. And the best thing for me about the Labour Party is that it's a place of equality. You know, whether you're disabled, neurodiverse, ethnic minority, you know, the Labour Party are here for you. And that is why I was so happy to see a Labour government. Personally, you know, based off my personal experiences with my sister, it is something that's so important to me. And I was so happy to see Keir Starmer deliver the smashing mandate that he did.
What have you made of the distraction, let's say, of what we've been discussing in terms of the winter fuel allowance and also the issues around gifts and freebies? You know, as we heard there from Jessica Toll, she's trying to get across the policies that they want to talk about. But ultimately, the headlines have been made for the wrong reasons. Do you understand the distraction and why people like me and the papers and the TV and the radio journalists want to talk to them about it?
Look, I think I understand why journalists will want to talk about it. It's a pressing issue. But what I also think is that tough decisions need to be made. I mean, people need to understand the level of austerity that we've inherited because of 14 years of Tory chaos and failure. You know, I mean, a £22 billion black hole is something that needs to be tackled. And I think the winter fuel payments is a start to that. And it's not the end. Yeah. There's tough decisions that need to be made to bring about the change that we want to. You know, a decade of national renewal. You know, change doesn't happen in 2 minutes. You need to make tough, bold decisions, right? As the Conservatives might have said, bold decisions. And we are a government that will do that.
Yeah, I mean, we keep hearing about this $22 billion black hole. It is debatable exactly how much. I guess we'll also see about tomorrow from the Chancellor exactly how they mean to address that. But there is the argument, look, you can't be surprised at the state of the finances. You've had access to a lot of documents way before you were elected. Labour obviously are keen to trumpet their policies, Liam. At the same time, connected to what we've just been discussing, that there is a little bit of disunity within the party. You know, we've seen the revolt in terms of the winter fuel payment. We saw it in terms of the two-child benefit. Do you think it's damaging this early on to Keir Starmer and his leadership to have a party that has been divided? I'm not saying, look, it's falling apart, but there are certainly, you know, divisions within the party. And we're only 80 days in, aren't we?
I mean, I'd take the view of this division over the chaos that we've had over the past 14 years. I think if this is the biggest news that we've got, then hopefully we've got a bright future ahead of us. And that's not to disparage how important it is to some people about the winter fuel payment, particularly as Jess was saying just before, the people who are £2, £3, £4 over, like, the blunt instrument of government is never, never helpful. And that's actually why the conversation about devolved government is a really important one, because you can talk about means tested or not, and you can talk about the instruments that are required to plug this black hole. But I think that we all know that what we really want is power closer to where we live and power closer into the hands of communities. And actually, maybe these big blunt instruments don't quite feel as painful when decisions are taken more locally.
Okay. Has either of you been to any parties, out with any MPs at the bar yet? What's it like behind the curtain, behind the scenes?
just been to Labour Together and the Tony Blair Institute, and then before that, Liverpool Labour. So, you know, leaning from one side of the party to the other.
Okay.
Everyone is saying the same things, which is that we're looking for a bit of interest and positivity from the big hitting speeches coming, and I think everyone's excited. We are just at the beginning, and and everyone seems pretty excited about that.
Have you shared a bottle of Chablis or a non-alcohol alternative Krish with any ministers or anything like that?
Well, look, I mean, I was at the Northwest reception yesterday, and everyone's there. You know, Keir, Angela, and Rachel all gave a speech. Look, I agree with what Liam was saying about the mood. It is really optimistic, you know, and we talk to these ministers and they all say the same thing. It's that tough decisions need to be made.
Okay. I like the way you're referring to them, the first name terms as well. you're obviously on the in crowd. Krish, thank you very much. Liam, thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the conference, won't you?
You're welcome.
Liam Kelly there and Krish Dharayanani, their politics student. Of course, we always welcome you getting in touch with us. 850-58 is the number to text, and we'll take your calls as well. 08085 909 693. We'll keep that running throughout the programme, and we'll turn our attention away from politics in a moment's time. We're going to take a look at home education and also fussy eating, both topics that I'd really like to talk to you about. Right now, though, 28 minutes to 11. Let's get the update.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The issue of private donations has clouded the first day of the Labour conference in Liverpool. Deputy Prime Minister Angela Rayner says she understands why some people are angry, but insists that the government followed the rules and has been transparent. President Biden says the US will do all it can to provide a wider war in the Middle East. The UN says the latest attacks between Israel and Hezbollah have brought the Middle East to the brink of an imminent catastrophe. The Justice Secretary says she's furious that some prisoners have been released early without ankle tacks. Shabana Mahmood has been demanding answers from the prison's contractor Serco and says the company could face penalties. And Liam Gallagher says imposters aren't welcome at the Oasis reunion concerts next year. It's after he was criticised for a performance before the fight between Anthony Joshua and Daniel Dubois. Reviews were mixed, but he says that people didn't appreciate his angelic tones. Well, what a game it proved to be at the Etihad Stadium today, with drama right up until the very end. The match between Premier League title rivals Manchester City and Arsenal ended 2-2. Erling Haaland had opened the scoring with his 100th goal for City. Arsenal hit back through Ricardo Calafiori and Gabriel, although Leandro Trossard was sent off in first half stoppage time. Mikel Arteta's side held out until the 98th minute, when substitute John Stones got City's equaliser. Arteta felt his side showed some great courage to keep their opponents at bay for so long with 10 men.
We did a lot of things good, but it's very difficult. It's an accident waiting to happen. You play the best team in the world for 56 minutes with 10 men, which doesn't allow you to put any pressure on the ball, doesn't allow you to get out from your own box, and they don't lose the ball. So they lose it inside the six-yard box, which means that there's no option either to run. So very complicated, but again, for these players to be that humble and that disciplined and show that competitiveness is just incredible.
Well, Brighton and Nottingham Forest drew 2-2 at the Amex. Both managers were red carded late on in the game, along with the Forest player Morgan Gibbs-White. In the Championship, the Preston North End forward Milutin Osmajic could face a lengthy ban after appearing to bite Owen Beck during their goalless draw against Blackburn Rovers. Celtic scored four times in the last 20 minutes in beating Falkirk 5-2 in the last of the Scottish League Cup quarterfinals. Brendan Rodgers accepted responsibility for Celtic's lacklustre performance until he made those changes.
We bring on the guys that have been playing and have been working, and then straight away the final 30 minutes, the fluidity in the team is at a really high level, so then we can then create goals and score goals and end up finishing the game really well.
And in the draw for the semi-finals of the Scottish League Cup, Celtic will take on Aberdeen. Motherwell will play the holders Rangers. In today's Women's Super League action, it finished 2-2 between Arsenal and Manchester City. Liverpool and Leicester ended one apiece, and Tottenham defeated newcomers Crystal Palace 4-0, while Celtic beat the Ukrainian side Volska Poltava 1-0 in the first leg of their Women's Champions League qualifier. On to motorsport, Lando Norris for McLaren was the comfortable winner of the Singapore Grand Prix. Max Verstappen was way back in second. Now, the victory has taken Norris to 52 points off the championship leader with six races to go. And Verstappen acknowledges it's now tightening up at the top.
Yeah, it is. But this also can change very quickly again. So we just need to keep on trying, keep to, of course, at one point try to overturn it a bit, you know, not always finishing behind. But we'll see how that goes.
In golf, there was a three-way playoff for the European Tour's PGA Championship title today at Wentworth. Rory McIlroy, South Africa's Tristan Lawrence, and the American player Billy Horschel all finished on 20 under par. But it was Horschel who came out on top of the second extra hole to win the title for the second time.
Listen, my heart was pounding on, you know, the last couple of shots, the last couple of holes, and especially in the playoff. But it's always fun being in those situations. That's what we work so hard for. That's what I've worked so hard for. That's what I've always wanted to be in situations like that, trying to win tournaments, going against the best players in the world, and hopefully being able to come out on top. And in the day, I was able to nip Rory and Tristan and come away with a victory.
And cricket's 50-over one-day cup final between Somerset and Glamorgan will go into a reserve day at Trent Bridge after a washout there today. That's the latest BBC Sports.
There are a few sibling rivalries that have gripped us quite like that of Liam and Noel Gallagher.
He had a row with me. Should we have a fight? And that was it. And then I trashed the place, yeah.
The rise and fall of Oasis, a band committed to the rock and roll dream.
I mean, we're not angels, but we're not supposed to make up.
Join me, Steve Lamacq.
And me, Joe Wiley, as we not only celebrate the music that Oasis made, but also delve into the complex and unruly rivalry.
There's only so many, like, olive branches you can give someone, you know what I mean? But that's life.
A band with your brother, that would become the Achilles heel in the end.
The rise and fall of Oasis.
Listen now on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network.
Johnny Ianson.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Yes, hello, good evening. 23 minutes to 11. It is Johnny in for Stephen tonight. Thank you to those getting in touch. 85058 is the number to text. And a lot of you getting in touch regarding the issues around freebies and gifts in Parliament at the moment. We'll spend a bit of time going through those texts in the next 5 or 10 minutes time. I would love you to get in touch on our next topic as well, because this is an issue close to my heart right now. If you've tried in vain, inevitably, to get your kids to try new foods, parents, it is not your fault. And I'm saying that again for myself. Me, it isn't. Johnny, listen to me. It is not your fault. Why do I feel like such a failure then? I've got a four-year-old, to add a little bit of context. And she, listen, for a four-year-old, I think she's great. She does really well. She's got a big issue with foods touching, foods mixed together. And weirdly, she really just loves to eat pizza and chips and cheese. I know, strange, isn't it? Who likes those foods? But listen, a major new study led by researchers from UCL King's College London and the University of Leeds suggests fussy eating is mostly down to genetics rather than parenting styles. Claire Llewellyn is an associate professor in behavioural sciences and health at UCL and a senior author on the study.
As any parent will know, when they have more than one child, often one child seems to be quite an adventurous eater. They eat lots of different types of foods and they happily join in with meals. And their sibling might be much less so. So they might reject foods based on particular textures or tastes, eat a limited range of foods, and be really reluctant to try new foods that they haven't had before. And we were just trying to find out why this is. So why are children so different?
So if you are affected by this, please do get in touch. 85058 is the number to text if you're going through this right now. But also, just to broaden it out, because this in no way is exclusive to parents, I would love to hear from you about the things that you just cannot eat, especially if it's mainstream, especially if you just cannot bring yourself to eat potatoes, if you hate cheese. Slightly different, but my brother-in-law doesn't drink hot drinks, and I just can't trust anybody that doesn't drink tea. For me, it's frankly weird, and I don't mind saying that out loud. Also, if you are compelled to eat only one thing, or if you just find you want to eat one thing all the time, the weird or the wonderful or whatever, please do get in touch. 85058 is the number to text. But also, I don't want to make too much of light of it because it can be a real issue. Dr. Susanna Forward joins us, an associate professor of psychology at Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge and a cognitive psychologist specialising in food choice behaviour. Goodness me, do I need you now, Dr. Forward?
Good evening.
Do I need you now? So why is it then that we don't all... I mean, there are certain foodstuffs that most people like, aren't there? But why is it that perhaps we're wired all so differently to like lots of different things?
Well, the study touches on it to some extent, which is genetics. We all have different genes. So we could start there. But that doesn't really speak to the whole picture. So to speak to genetics, we experience food through our mouth, taste, and also through our sense of smell. And we all have just differences in terms of how we sense the world. So if you're quite, I don't know, hypersensitive to bitterness, things that you might actually quite dislike the flavour of some things that someone else doesn't mind because they can't really taste that bitter flavour quite so much. I'm chuckling at the cheese comment. My husband and my mother-in-law both really do not like cheese.
Really?
And for
do
them,
you,
it
do you
really...
still speak to them, I don't.
I know. I've trained them on tomato. Mozzarella, far as we can go.
An entry-level cheese.
Entry-level melted cheese is doable. It has reminiscences or similarities with vomit as a flavour.
Oh,
so
wow.
Obviously they're not thrilled at that.
Yeah.
You know, that's not appealing. And that really speaks to the genetic difference in the sense that their sensory receptors are reacting to the food in a way that makes it feel similar to something which for them and for me and for you is revolting. So their reaction is entirely normal given the receptors that they have. So our genetics does have a part to play. Another thing that you touched on children, it's actually really good that children are really cautious about what they put in their mouths. We often as parents complain that children don't eat stuff, but frankly, you know, if they're a four-year-old going through the world, you probably wish they wouldn't put as much stuff in their mouths as they actually do. So a little bit of caution around that is really naturally quite healthy, and that's probably why evolutionarily children are more, we call it sort of neophobic around food, so more cautious around eating foods than adults.
Yeah.
A second variable.
I can see how that's helpful, but I couldn't get my little and tweet spaghetti bolognese, but then I couldn't stop her putting Hot Wheels cars into her mouth, for instance.
Biting the dolls
off of Barbies.
In the space of children's diet, what I would just say is once you've worked out what they'll eat, don't worry about giving them that on repeat. As long as you're kind of covering the major food groups, there's a fruit vegetable in there, there's a bit of protein in there, there's a bit of carbohydrate in there. It doesn't matter if it's maybe relatively narrow in variety at that age, because Getting a fruit or veg, a bit of protein and a bit of carbohydrate into them is probably a bigger problem than anything else. And the rest will come. And that's really just to reassure parents. It will come. Honestly, it will come. You eat other foods with them. They will eventually eat those foods. So that's just a question of patience and allowing the child to grow up. The final thing you said about, you know, why do we like what we like, is familiarity. We like what we know. And if you think about, again, going back to the kind of safety and hazard of food, eating something's potentially really dangerous if you don't know what it is. You know, it's a really you're putting something inside your body. You don't want that to be something that might harm you. So your body has a really natural defense to that, which is, I'm not going to put something in my mouth that's unfamiliar. We've probably all been on holiday to foreign places and had food served to us, and we've looked at it and gone, I'm not sure what that is. It doesn't feel appealing. I'll just not eat it. And that's a really normal reaction to something very unfamiliar in the context of food.
And so, obviously the nature's important, but also the nurture side of things. I mean, I've read several things where they say, for instance, look, if you want her to eat broccoli, just keep putting it on her plate. She will not eat it. Yeah. She will push it to one side, but that's familiarity fine. Element eventually. Sure. May, I'm fingers crossed, hopefully will lead her to eating it. But I've not seen
it's
the evidence of that in real life. Oh, goodness me, is it long?
It's a long game. Food fussiness lasts from, what is it? I think it's something like 3 to 8 years old, 10 years old. It's a long game. You're talking years here. And the second thing is the exposure. Parents often go, well, I've tried it 3 or 4 times. No. 10, 15, 20 times. But even then, I mean, there's just make sure that your child is exposed to the breadth of food that you have in your diet. And that's easy because you're eating those foods. So even if your child doesn't eat them, you've got the rest of the dish. You know, you can take a little bit of the family dish for the child to be introduced to it. You don't have to specially cook broccoli just for your child. You can include them in the family meals as much as possible. And that's the other important thing to say about food. It's a social activity. We are all swayed by what we see the people around us doing. So my husband, when with his family as a child, wouldn't eat cheese at all. But at university, we were all, you know, pizza features, because it does.
Yeah.
And he was like, I'm missing out. This looks fun. It actually doesn't smell that bad. Oh, this is a version of cheese that's not familiar to me, but everyone seems to be enjoying it. And that's, everyone is persuaded by that. Social aspect of course.
Let me read a text to you, because we are joking, but actually it is really stressful at times. This study,
it really is. It's really, really, really hard. This is a really big topic.
This study has come at such a good time. Mealtimes with my 1-year-old have me in tears constantly. Yeah. He'll only eat two foods. Everyone has different advice about, have you tried doing this? Have you tried doing that? Like, as a mum, I haven't tried everything I can think of. Constantly worry, full of guilt about what he eats, because other kids are eating adventurously. Yeah. It breaks my heart. Yeah. I mean, that is a genuinely serious side of it.
Absolutely.
Thing that I my wife was reading lots of books about this, was really, really keen to tell me about how actually our forcefulness and the pressure that we put on them, and finish your food on your plate and you must eat this, can cause real issues in later life, perhaps unsurprisingly now we think about it rationally.
Yeah, and we have to take the pressure off to some extent. And I think that's where, I mean, nobody eats under pressure. Again, think about yourself. If someone said, here, have this, you must eat it.
Yeah.
Does that really engage you in a positive relationship with that food item? Forcefulness isn't good, but neither is strong emotion. And that's really hard, because it feels so important. As parents, we really want the best for our children. So we are feeling all the emotions. Sometimes a bit of indifference is quite helpful. Step back, step away, and leverage the positivity of other people you can get. My son and my nephew are about the same age, and my nephew is a bit more fussy than my son. Was a sort of omnivore, human dustbin, would eat anything. And so every time I went to see my family, my sister was like, let's just get them together and sit them together, just because then we as parents can step back and they'd have the positivity of each other. So as parents, don't feel that you have to be in there all the time. Allow other people to work their magic, because your child will react differently to different people. My children were forever eating different things with their grandparents or at friends' houses. They wouldn't eat with me. That's fine. I don't mind.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, when you're not there, but maybe your child is having a meal with someone else and you know that they're more willing to be a bit more open or willing to eat something, just kind of gently say, you know, just let me know. I'm thrilled that they are. I don't need to be there and find out. But, you know, use that. And that's, I suppose, what I would encourage. But really do not stress about it. It's a long game. And you, if you're worried about your children's dietary health, that is an important question to talk to your GP about. But actually, the major food groups is really all we need to think about. And, you know,
relax.
They don't need to eat the whole rainbow of vegetables. Just they relax. Can just eat. Just one is fine.
Great
advice. Relax,
Is it just finally, is there anything that you can't eat that you know you should or that's very popular, Susanna?
I think, you see, I'm the omnivore in the family
as well.
Of course
you are.
I was most challenged on a holiday to China where we were fed jellyfish.
Really?
I feel like that might... Pickled jellyfish, a very strange combination of slimy and crunchy.
There's so much to eat in the world. I don't know how we arrive at a point where someone said, you know what? I think what we need is to pickle jellyfish because that's the foodstuff the world needs.
I can't really claim I'm a picky eater, but I'm very sympathetic.
That doesn't make you a picky eater, by the way.
No, I struggled with fat and gristle on meat for a long time and it would just stop me eating halfway through a meal. I'd be like, I've just found a bit of gristly bit. Now I just can't eat anymore. Like whatever else is on my plate, I'd have to stop. As a child, I think that was for me a big barrier, was the sort of textural stuff. I think that's really common. It's often texture.
Nobody likes gristle. Dr. Forward, lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much.
You too. Take care.
Thank you. I'd love to hear your text on this, please. Both, the lighter ones and the more serious as well, please. The foodstuffs that you just cannot eat, especially if it's mainstream, or maybe just the weird and wonderful things that you are compelled to eat so much of. 8505 is the number to text, or you can call and WhatsApp us on 08085 909 693. Use those numbers to get in touch about the next topic as well, actually, because remember homeschooling, that thing from the pandemic? Well, it's making a comeback with new government data showing that there's been a sharp increase in the number of kids being home educated since 2019. Let's dig a little bit deeper into this with a few people that have got all their own experiences of this. Dr. Carol Campbell is the principal educational psychologist for South Ayrshire Council in Scotland and joins us. Hi, Dr. Campbell.
Good evening.
And welcome to the programme, Lisa Owen and Suzanne Wildig, both parents and both home educated. Lisa, Suzanne, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Hello to Dr. Campbell first. Just from a professional perspective, what are your thoughts on the increase in home education?
I think the pandemic has had a significant impact on parents deciding to go down the route of home education. But what I would say is with every child and family, the reasons for home educating can be very different. So for some families, it's because the education system particularly haven't worked for them. So they have decided the best course of action is to withdraw from the education system and to take that on itself. And for other families, it's more that love of learning and maybe that they've experienced that, or that's something they've always wanted to do and that was always in their plans to do that. So I think every family and child and young person is very individual. But certainly my own experience is that there has been a rise in applications for homeschooling, and sometimes parents haven't been fully aware that that leaves the sole responsibility of the education for them, and where there's been problems with the school system, that trying to resolve those in the first instance would be something that education department would want to do. But certainly, you know, it is interesting that there has been that rise, and I think it's been because families have experienced home learning. More families have experienced home learning through that pandemic period.
Let's get a couple of different perspectives on this. Lisa, whose kids have been to school before, and Suzanne, whose children haven't actually been in mainstream education before. Lisa, we'll start with yourself. If you could just briefly sum up exactly why you've chosen to homeschool and what the experience has been like.
Yeah, so I think since the pandemic, I noticed a decline in my children's ability to kind of cope really with the mainstream school education system. I noticed a rapid decline in my daughter in the last 12 months to the point where she became quite unwell physically and mentally. And we took the decision in April to take her off the school register and do it ourselves. My son is actually currently still on the school roll, but is really struggling to attend. And I think a lot of it is due to the fact that they're neurodivergent and the school system just doesn't work. The mainstream system just does not work to meet their needs from a well-being perspective.
Would you, or did you consider any sort of special educational need instead, or was it automatically, I'm just going to take them out and do it myself?
I think actually my my daughter, who is home educated, academically is very bright. She's very capable, but unfortunately she just can't cope with the kind of the system as the system is. And it's not an individual school problem, but actually a system issue. And the fact that her well-being had taken such a knock, there's been a huge rise in young people being affected with their mental health. And I think I saw it myself firsthand. And I just thought, actually, do you know, I can do that. We can do this ourselves. Mm. You know, she wants to study. She wants to do her GCSEs. And we will do that with her. We will support her to do that. But with the well-being of kind of being in at home and not in the school system.
Suzanne, you've got a slightly different experience because your two children have never actually been in school, have they? Why did you choose to educate them yourself instead of putting them in mainstream education?
I just felt that I could do a better job, quite frankly. Right. I have myself, you know, one adult to two children, and in any school, no matter how good the school, there is going to be some 30 children to a teacher. There is no way to personalize the education to them. There's no way to follow their interests, to go down the rabbit holes that they're interested in, to branch out. You know, it's all for us very organic, rather than I stand there and kind of point at things on a blackboard or whiteboard, as the case may be.
Do you follow do you follow the curriculum?
No.
Right.
So I don't have to. No.
You don't have to. But what about when it comes to, for instance, them taking their GCSEs? I know they're only in primary school at the moment, or the equivalent, aren't they? Eight and 10. But what about, because the reality is that kids are taught to pass these GCSEs, aren't they? They don't,
of course.
They won't dictate their life, but they can certainly have a major influence on it.
Oh, absolutely. And I very much see my children going into higher education if that's what they want to do. So obviously there are steps to go there. But I'm luckily in a place where there are lots of other home eders, and I can see what their teenagers are doing. And I see people doing GCSEs as external candidates. You just need a year's kind of access course or a preparation course and you do your GCSEs. They also tend to spread their GCSEs over a few years. So rather than having all that pressure in that 1 year of doing many, many GCSEs at once, home eders can do two or three every year for a few years and have that as a much more relaxed pace. They can also go deeper into each subject as they're following their interests. They might do something that comes easier to them early on so that they can learn how the system sort of works, how you answer questions, that type of thing. And then they do the higher stakes ones like maths and such later on.
Let me bring back in Dr. Campbell. Do you worry at all, Dr. Campbell, when you hear about homeschooling that it might not necessarily prepare them for more formal environments that certain children might find themselves in, either in higher education or in the workplace?
I think that all homeschooling environments can be very different, and I don't have any direct experience of homeschooling environments, but what I would say is the structure of school and it is very similar to that of many working environments, so it is good preparation for working environments, being there for a certain time, going through learning that you select, but also going through learning that comes from the curriculum. Those skills in terms of independence, being able to operate independently of your family, are certainly skills that are practiced in school. Mm-hmm. And the social skills of other children and negotiating with other children and problem solving social situations, which I'm sure can happen in homeschooling, but probably happens on a wider sense within the school environment. And I suppose that learning to cooperate with others around all different areas of the curriculum can be particularly helpful in terms of that long lens of whole life and looking towards preparation.
Let me put that to both parents. And Lisa, I know obviously your children may, with neurodivergent kids, that's something that you have to address perhaps separately anyway. But do you worry about the social aspect of it?
No. Actually, I think my children, they socialise with a range of people of all different ages. They might be with younger children, might be with children their own age, might be with some older teens, some older adults, and they kind of learn to negotiate and learn to, you know, do all the things that they would learn at school, but on a probably more equal playing field, and it's probably less hierarchical in the home education system. I think what I've recognised with my daughter particularly is that socially she couldn't cope at school because she was completely burnt out.
Right.
Actually now she socialises much more with her friends from school still, but also children that she's meeting, you know, much more widely within our local town, or, you know, from home ed groups that we might be linking in with. So yeah. I have absolutely no concerns from a social perspective
and
at all.
Suzanne, sorry, just final 30 seconds. I'm just conscious of time. But on that, are you comfortable with the way your children are socialising and feel confident that when they move into the world of work and the grown-up world, they'll be fully ready for it?
I would say that a school environment is extremely artificial because in the grown-up world, they will never have to get on with 30 people that are born exactly within a year of them and, you know, for better or for worse, get on with them. My children, as Lisa was saying, they are getting on with all kinds of ages. You know, in a homeschool environment, you've got teenagers, little kids, they all get on together, and the older ones are actually in a really good place teaching the younger ones because they're kind of closer in age than an adult. So it often actually helps them learn.
Interesting. Some really interesting perspectives. Thank you both so much for joining us this evening. Lisa Owen, Susan Wildig and Dr. Carol Campbell there. Love to hear your thoughts and experiences on this. Get in touch with the programme tonight, 08085 909 693 or the text 85058. The update is on the way.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. This is Charlotte Simpson. President Biden has said the United States will do everything in its power to prevent an escalation of conflict in the Middle East. Cross-border exchanges of fire between the Iranian-backed Hezbollah group in Lebanon and the Israeli military have intensified. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, explained what Israel's next steps might be.
It seems absolutely set on this path of escalation at the moment. They have reinforced their forces on the border and people are talking that maybe the next stage or a few stages ahead could be a ground operation sending in troops and tanks into Lebanon.
The issue of private donations such as free clothing and holidays overseas has continued to plague Keir Starmer on the first day of the Labour conference in Liverpool. The Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, said she understood why some people were angry, but she insisted the government had followed the rules. Baroness Hodge, who was a Labour MP for nearly 30 years, says the issue has become a distraction.
I know Keir well. He's not a Boris Johnson. He's not somebody who acts with impunity. And I think he will be as devastated as everybody else that this went wrong. But they've stopped it. And I think this is the moment that we bring forward really, really clear, strong proposals to clean up politics, to set the rules, to ensure they're properly enforced and to ensure proper accountability to the public.
A second man has been arrested in connection with the kidnap of an 87-year-old man in Oldham. The pensioner was reportedly dragged into a car and attacked as he was being driven around while demands were made for his money. He was eventually dumped in West Yorkshire. The left-wing opposition candidate, Anura Kumara Dissanayake, has won Sri Lanka's presidential election after an historic second round of counting. He has promised voters tough anti-corruption measures and to revive the economy. Manchester City are at the top of the Premier League table after a 2-2 draw against Arsenal at the Etihad. Arsenal played the second half with 10 men but were holding on to their lead until John Stones scored in the 98th minute. The Manchester City manager, Pep Guardiola, had praise for the Arsenal defence.
They put four players.